From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people.
Welcome to The Media Project, WAMC's weekly program that looks at the ins and outs and the ups and downs of the media. I'm Judy Patrick of the New York Press Association. Rex Smith, who usually monitors this program, is away this week. Here with me are Alan Shartok. He's the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Kaylin Brown, she's the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. Also with us today is Ian Pickus. He is the news director here at WAMC. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks for having me. And just remember, I'm at the control board.
Yeah.
Be nice.
So let's start this week with a really probably the most important media story in my mind. This is what the lasting implications will be are yet to be determined. But Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas came out this week with an opinion in which he questioned New York Times versus Sullivan. This is the landmark case involving the First Amendment. It dates from the early 60s. And in that decision, the Supreme Court expanded press freedom by creating a high burden of proof for public officials alleging they have been defamed. Thomas, in his opinion this week, says maybe that high bar needs to be lowered a bit. What do you think? Is this a real assault on the First Amendment, or is just this just tilting at windmills on Thomas's part?
Well, I'll be honest with you. New York Times versus Sullivan has at times stuck in my craw. And we've talked about it here on the Media Project. Let me tell you that, as you know, the rule is if you're a public figure, you have different rights than if you are not a public figure. You can be sued, but you have to prove actual malice. And that's a tough thing to do, so almost nobody gets sued as a result of that. You can. It's theoretically possible. It just doesn't really work. Now, we know what's going on with Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas is the butt of everybody's jokes. As a Supreme Court justice, he's terrible. Or as Jean Shalit once said of Ishtar, terrible. He's terrible. He doesn't, you know, he is a guy who is obviously silent. He's in over his head. People say it all the time. I'm saying it right now. And as a result, he gets ticked off. He wants that to be changed so that he could sue somebody if they open their mouths. But he's not alone. There's this other guy, Donald Trump. And that's something we have to talk about today because it's huge. He's going after the New York Times. He's saying they're enemies of the people. We have a suspect being arrested because he buys the Trump line and he's going after all of Trump's potential enemies. Look, when you open your big fat mouth, as Trump has done about the press, and make them the problem, because he knows very well that the Mueller report is coming and that it may well get out in the press, and he's trying to figure out how he avoids that. So to me, the thing that has always bothered me is I've had people say some things that are literally libelous about me, and I want to sue them. And as soon as I say I want to sue them, people say to me, you can't, because you're a public figure and you've purposely injected yourself into the public discourse. I just think we have a dual system. For some people, they can sue for libel, and some people they can't.
But remember that the people who benefit from that dual system include the elected officials who benefit on multiple levels. And if we have questions of accountability with our elected officials already, this gives them another out. If they were able to do what Peter Thiel did with Gawker, yeah. When the Hulk Hogan story came around and Hogan won a lawsuit against Gawker, but he was supported by big money. He was concerned about his reputation, and that resulted in the end of Gawker. Eventually.
So what? Gawker was terrible.
Gawker did some good stuff on the Spitzer Client Number 9 story for many, many months. Aside from that, it seems that it would be a problem if Thomas were successful with this proposal to change and give public figures an out. They should be held to a higher standard.
Well, I get this business about a higher standard, but I don't really agree with you because I think if somebody is libeled, they should be allowed to sue for libel.
Now, look,
I'm a journalist. Yeah, but you know, they have no chance of winning because of the rules that were set up in New York Times versus Sullivan. And as a result, we have one rule for people like me and one rule for everybody else. I don't like that.
So what do you think about Alan being wrong, Ian?
Let me pivot and raise an alternate theory here. There was a story not long ago by Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker that said Clarence Thomas might be thinking about retiring. And he's in his mid-70s. There's a Republican president, so President Trump has been courting Thomas and his wife, who's a known actor in right-wing causes. Maybe Clarence Thomas is just trying to get something in the record by tucking this opinion into an unrelated piece of writing about the Sullivan case before he goes out the door.
Because he wants to sue someone, Ian, could he be upset that his own reputation was defamed during his hearing? I love what you're saying.
I'm sure he is upset about it, but maybe he's just looking at a legacy. Supreme Court justices know every word they write will be looked at for years and years and decades and decades. And if Thomas is going potentially this spring, maybe this was one of the last chances to get this down. Just a conspiracy theory.
Well, it's an interesting theory because let's remember what this is all about. Where did Thomas see fit to write this? He wrote it in a concurring opinion over somebody, a woman who wanted to sue Cosby.
That's right.
And it turned out that the court said, no, you can't do that under our rules. But Thomas wrote a concurring opinion saying, yeah, the result was right, but here's my theory on why people should be allowed and to change. And New York Times versus Sullivan needs to be overturned. We know that this court is capable of overturning things. We're all worried, or many of us are, about overturning Roe v. Wade right now. But what was interesting is he offered this concurring opinion, and nobody on the court concurred with his concurrence. If you're following me.
I am following you.
You know, if this case, if that decision gets overturned, I think media companies are going to be spending all their time defending libel lawsuits rather than reporting the news. This is established, so it gives the press and the freedom to pursue public officials and to ask them important questions. Newspapers, media companies make mistakes, and a lot of times these mistakes are non-intentional. All of them are, I mean, I can probably say most of them, 99% are non-intentional. And to have to demonstrate a reckless disregard as the truth, I think, is a reasonable standard to set, and not one that should be overturned and ignored. You know, this comes into play with the lawsuit that has been filed this week against the Washington Post by the young man's family who was at the center of the debate at the Washington Mall. He is charging that the Washington Post libeled him, and part of the defense on the media's part, and we expect a lot of other organizations to be sued as well, is the fact that that young man became a public figure by inserting himself into that protest. What do you think? Do you think that's fair?
Well, first of all, I want to make my position eminently clear, and that is, whether people agree with this or not, I write two columns every week. I've had people upset with me, and I love the idea that I have a certain amount of protection because I almost exclusively write about public figures. So there is that. I am conflicted on this one, but I'm perfectly happy for Sullivan versus the New York Times to continue as the mainstay of our libel law.
Thank you very much.
What's interesting about the Kentucky Catholic Covington story and this lawsuit about that young man concerned about how his image was damaged, I think, has to do with how that whole story began. There was a very small clip on YouTube that was only a microcosm of what was actually happening. So we didn't have the full context of how that played out. And as a result, we saw CBS later on in the news cycle spending about 20 minutes, it felt like, talking about what really was happening. And they had footage from multiple cameras. They did a great job further exploring this and reporting the story. So we know that our citizens are out there exercising their free speech rights when they pick up their iPhones or their smartphones and record something. That's how we find out a lot about police brutality. So there's value in capturing that image. But the media, especially legacy, mainstream, and any other reputable organizations, have an obligation to make sure that the reporting has been done before they traffic in problematic content.
Professor Brown, if I may, let me just say, I am thinking that this Clarence Thomas thing is a harbinger of bad things. Okay, but he is almost irrelevant. What is not irrelevant is the President of the United States. using his bully pulpit, as he has for the last several days, attacking the New York Times viciously. And a very gutsy A.J. Sulzberger comes back, the publisher of the Times, comes back very vigorously and goes after him and tells him that he doesn't understand what the implications of what he's doing are. But I think he understands fine. I think he sees the Mueller report, as I've already said, coming out. He knows the Times has been devoting tremendous resources to the whole thing, and he just wants to sully the entire news media in this country as much as he can. Hey, look, it's all we got. It may not be perfect, but when you look at Nazi Germany, you look at the Soviet Union, you look at all of these failed governmental apparatus, you get the idea that without a free press, you're nothing.
You know, we talk about whether or not what the president's comments really mean and whether it will result in lawsuits or violence. So we've got lawsuits filed in the case of Nick Salmon, the Covington student. We also have this week is the story about the Coast Guard lieutenant who has been charged with trying to kill a lot of people, including a lot of media types. Does that make people worried?
Two quick points. Back to the Covington High School student, I'll just repeat what I tell the kids in my media law and ethics class, which is when you go outside, you forfeit a certain amount of privacy. And when you go to a protest on the National Mall, you're giving up a lot of privacy. And what happens there is going to be fair game to be covered. As to the president's rhetoric, I just found it funny that 19 days before the latest attacks, based on the report on the Mueller report, he had invited Mr. Sulzberger to a dinner date, was rebuffed, ended up having an on-the-record interview with the two reporters and the publisher, and said, "I'm entitled to one good story from my hometown paper at least." 3 weeks later, enemy of the people, can't believe a word in there. So the closer you look, you know, the more hypocrisy you see on this particular issue, I think.
Well, yeah. You know, the idea of he's offended, and the idea is you're playing cards, and you have to make sure every once in a while he gets an ace. He says, so I need to have a good story. You guys have to give me a good story, as if it has nothing to do with objectivity. It's disgusting.
You know, every politician wants a good story. Every business owner wants a good story. Probably every person wants a good story.
Absolutely. Reporters and editors do, right?
Yeah, but do people deserve good stories? No, they just deserve the truth.
Well.
What do you think?
No. Well, let's.
Who deserves a good story?
Let's be honest about this.
What's a good story? Well, Watergate.
Well, a great story.
You know, but let's be honest about this. Every once in a while, you see something in a newspaper which is I don't know how to describe it without getting kicked off the radio, but which is suspicious in that let's give the mayor's wife made cookies or
it's
something
like that.
It's
a puff piece, as
yeah,
we call it.
Puff pieces. And why you, Judy, were an editor for a long time, why do you do puff pieces?
Well, I like to think that I don't do a lot of puff pieces, but we do human interest stories. We do try to balance them and try to limit the idea of focusing on the children of the mayor and what wonderful students they are. There is the balance. People do want to see these people as human beings with, you know, who cook dinner, who play in baseball leagues, but you've got to balance your coverage. But agreed, everybody does want that puff piece, and it is something that editors have to resist.
I'll think about the Nancy Pelosi story the Times had. I think it was the Times, could have been the Washington Post. One of those two talking about how motherhood and raising those five kids informed her entire professional career. That was a great story. It was just well-reported. It was a unique angle. She grabbed right onto the reporter and said, yes, I want to talk about that because what I went through as a mother absolutely helped me make decisions and be the leader I am today.
And how about you, Professor? Has it helped you being a mother in terms of your perspective?
Motherhood is the best thing that ever happened to me, Alan.
It is.
Absolutely.
So in the battle of the sexes, mm-hmm. when you think about it, fathers can't be mothers. And therefore, it makes women kind of special, doesn't it?
Well, mothers can't be fathers either. There's that.
Well, I'm not sure what that means, Judy.
We're going to have very different language as we move forward in the world, I think. Pronouns are changing. There's a lot of change afoot. And so journalism is going to be adjusting to these changes.
If there's any journalism left, every time I talk to a newspaper editor these days, I talk to our wonderful friend Ken Lovett, who is retiring from the Daily News and who's gotten a job in a different area. He's out, and he talks about what's going on in the newspaper industry, which is the newspapers are being sold repeatedly. The Daily News is allegedly up for sale again. I don't know if that's right. And so one wonders whether there is going to be anything left. Who will be the last person standing? Probably the New York Times.
Well, that's another reason why it's valuable that the New York Times v. Sullivan stays in place, because that does provide the sort of protection that's necessary. I wonder if our listeners are aware of what the New York Times v. Sullivan case was about.
Go ahead, kid.
Well, just very quickly, because it occurs to me that many people wouldn't remember or weren't alive for, about 1964, when an advertisement was placed in a newspaper in Montgomery, Alabama, about the Civil Rights Movement there. And some of the language in the ad was wrong. It was not intentional. It was accidental. There were accidental mistakes about what had happened around police trying to take care or pay attention to the civil rights activists.
Things about the use of dogs.
Right. So the commissioner of police then sued the New York Times, saying his reputation had been damaged.
As it had.
In this advertisement.
It had, hadn't it?
He was not named, and the court determined that no. His reputation had not been damaged.
Well, how do we know that? You don't know that. We didn't take a poll afterwards.
No.
Here's a guy who says, I was maligned. They said I did things I didn't do. And therefore, I've been hurt. And the court, I think properly, came up with a critique of that and said, no, the more important thing is the freedom of the press.
Well, there was no malice there. The Times did not do that intentionally. What's especially interesting about the case is to remember it's an advertisement. It's not even the news content of the paper. It was in an ad. But it provided a valuable foundation for journalism to pursue its quest.
And I think the journalists at the time made the argument that if we don't have racism and segregation in the South to cover, then we won't cover it.
Good point.
You know, can we take a few minutes to jump over to CNN, which this week announced the hiring of Sarah Isger, who was the Justice Department's head spokeswoman under Attorney General Jeff Sessions. They've hired her to be their political editor coming.
That's huge.
And it is big. But while people go from politics to public service a lot, I don't like that idea at all. This is really the first time someone's been tapped to be an editor, which overseas coverage is different. What do you think? Is this different than George Stephanopoulos going over? And what's the impact it will have on the coverage going forward, especially in 2020?
Well, I don't like to get involved in people's motives. I don't know what the motive was of CNN doing it. But CNN has been repeatedly accused of being to the left of center. And maybe, somebody sitting up in a boardroom and said, well, you know, this is a woman who was basically defending the indefensible Justice Department, and now we're going to bring her over, and we're going to make her our editor. So they must have known something we don't know in terms of her ability to, you know, to be a professional here.
To its credit, CNN has now demonstrated with evidence that they are trying not to be the liberal media that they are being accused of. So they could use this hire simply as further argument that, see, we're not. We have hired this person who worked for Jeff Sessions. Could she control the narrative? She could absolutely control the narrative. Could the narrative change? Certainly it could, because she has already shown that she had worked for Jeff Sessions in this particular administration. Someone who says yes to working in this administration has clearly set themselves up for being judged.
I agree.
I'm conflicted on this one because I think about the greatest Meet the Press host of my lifetime, Tim Russert. Just the eminent TV journalist, knew how to question politicians. What was his background? He came up through Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Mario Cuomo.
That's true.
So, but I think if viewers know that, they can decide for themselves. I think the problem might be if you didn't know that George Stephanopoulos had been a top press aide in the Clinton administration and you saw him interviewing Hillary Clinton, then maybe there is a question there. Should he be barred from a life of journalism 30 years after that administration ends? I don't know.
You know, back in the day, this idea of jumping back and forth over the line between public service or government work and the press, it was a pretty solid line and people didn't do it. But they're jumping back and forth like it's jump rope. And it's concerning to me because whether or not it impacts who they talk to when they're in public service or how they cover the news going forward. And again, this is an important position. And this person doesn't have a journalism background. For me, it portends the idea that CNN really cares less about journalism and more about entertainment and gaining ratings. Because remember how often CNN aired live the Trump rallies. It got them great ratings, but did it affect how Trump won all those primaries back in the day?
And it does feel, I think, different in this time, just knowing the administration's attitude, at least publicly, toward the press it receives. It does seem that we've gone a little farther than past administrations when you saw people, you know, going from the White House lectern to being a correspondent on the Today Show.
In fact, I've heard rumors that Joe Scarborough, Morning Joe, might want to run for president himself. Now, when I worked for Channel 6 back in the day, I worked for Channel 6 for a long time, then Channel 13, these were local people, and I was told, without question, I was told, you know, by Don Decker, the legendary news director at Channel 6, you have to promise me you'll never run for political office. And that was his standard. And then, in a story I like to talk to about too much, some foolish guy put a headline out that there were five candidates for the head of the Public Service Commission, and he listed me as one. I didn't even know what the Public Service Commission did. and Decker, you know, he was very angry with me, put it mildly. So, Judy, you're right. The standard has changed.
We've got just a few minutes left. I wanted to touch base on the Jesse Smollett case. That's the Empire actor who reported that he was attacked on the streets of Chicago, I think. And, you know, that story is developing, but there's some criticism of the press and how they handled that case. Did we jump to conclusions too quickly?
The press may have jumped too quickly. It's still difficult to tell.
They accepted the story that he was beaten up by, and it was homophobic remarks and anti-black remarks.
Yes.
And they accepted that without question.
They did accept it without question. It's valuable if a police report were filed saying that this celebrity had been the victim of a crime. It deserves being reported. It would always be reported, so that it was reported was good. But they should have sought more information. And the problem for me is this hurts future people who have actual complaints. Because just like that story about rape at the UVA campus in Rolling Stone magazine a few years, which was completely fabricated from my perspective and was pulled from the magazine, every time a victim comes forward, that is a brave act in itself. And if a person was not a victim, if it turns out Smollett was not a victim, he has hurt all the other people who come forward with victims' claims.
Well, we've finished another media project.
We have, Judy.
We have. Thank you all for spending half an hour with us today. Thanks, Ian, Alan, Kalen. If you have anything to say to us, please write us at media@wamc.org. We love getting your letters. We read them on the air as soon as it is the next week. Again, thanks a lot for listening.
A living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free news.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Kalen Brown is the Chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Judy Patrick is the Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.